It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo, South America, Australia, France, Germany, UK, Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running for another live program on the horn. Today is Wednesday, the 16th day of May 2018. HeadOn.live is where we live. And that's where you go if you should happen to decide to, participate in the chat room. The link is right there at headon.live, and all you have to do is pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and then zounds, you will be right there in the midst of all the hoopla and all the carrying on. The entire experience that is the madcap, wacky, zany, real-time, multimedia extravaganza that takes place during the 3 hours in which this program is live. Mm-hmm. Our buddy Jim's in there. Laborman's in there. DT Bomb's in there. Heather's in there. So's Anatole. And, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, because Marty wasn't quite sure who are you and where's my horse. Yes, I understand. I understand completely. Without it, so that we've taken care of that now. That's a good thing. Now let's see. This thing's circling and cycling and ner. Yeah. Okay. Just make sure we don't have any playback playing back. But yeah, the gang's all there, and We're shy a couple of moderators. Maybe pinch hit midweek utility chat room moderator and all around great guy Steve is on his way. Sparky takes prayer meeting off. We're live. Laborman says, "Is the program going?" Yes, the program is going. Hallelujah. So where do we begin? Well, we begin where we always begin, by saying thank you. And we have thank yous to extend to our subscribers. I try to thank everybody when contributions and donations roll in during the program. I try to extend the thank yous in real time when that takes place. But the subscribers roll in the wee small hours of the morning, so I like to thank them at the beginning of the program. Thank you very kindly to our buddy Reinhard over in Virginia, and to Timothy in Arizona. Thank you both very, very kindly indeed. Again, thanks to Mike in Cascadia for meeting Charlene's challenge at the very last minute last night. Much obliged. And so, consequently, though, those are our two subscribers, Timothy and Reinhard, for this, the 16th day of the month. If you'd like to be a subscriber, you know this, unless you're brand new to the program. You can be one of the significant minority of folks who listen to the program and help keep it on the air by simply going to headon.live and clicking on PayPal and clicking that little box. And if you put 10.00 into the box and click make this a recurring, or, you know, make this happen every month, or set it and forget it, or whatever it says there, well, you will be part of the group that's not quite the Happy 100, but we're working toward them. And someday the goal is to have the fan-freaking-tastic 400 so that I don't have to mention fundraising anymore. Okay? So that's, thank you again to Timothy and to Reinhard. Thank you so very, very much indeed. So where does that leave us? Well, that leaves us with $400 in fundraising this evening, $200 for this evening, and the $200 the shortfall that we have for the week so far. We've managed to knock down Monday. Yesterday's is pending, and tonight, and if we could knock down $400, we wouldn't have to have some sort of gigantic, terrifying deficit as we move into the end of the week. And, of course, we've passed the halfway point of May now. So the goal is to roll downhill until we get to, and I'll just remind folks, until we get to fundraising free radio, which would occur on Friday, a week from Friday, all the way to the end of May on the 31st. Okay? Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how that works out. If we can get to do a week of fundraising free radio, if we can make up all of the fundraising for the the regular part of the month. All right, good. So that means we've got to knock out yesterday, today, the 17th, the 18th, the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. All right. Tall order, I guess, but just the same. Start the program. Well, I'll get around to the prayer meeting Wednesday stuff eventually, but I'm going to start the program a little bit differently. I had a great note. I get these great emails. A great note from Lauren, our correspondent out in the frozen wastes of Alberta. And again, the issue that just for some, well, it gets a lot of people worked up, the whole Israel-Palestine miasma. So at about 1:19 this morning, an hour and 19 minutes past midnight, I got a note from Lauren. Subject line, another irritable Jew here. Yes, actually an atheist. Mighty disappointment to my family because I do believe there is apartheid in Israel, and I am horrified at the treatment of Palestinians. I may have mentioned my lovely but horribly misguided niece, who has made Aliyah, which means move to Israel, to become a citizen, works for an NGO called NGO Watch. This lovely group is funded largely by Sheldon Adelson. Her job is to investigate NGOs, ones like my favorite charity, Doctors Without Borders, and see if they're aiding Islamic, mainly Palestinian people. Yeah, because that's intolerable. One time they did find money from World Vision was mishandled and given to a Palestinian who bought some rockets. But this criminal enterprise my niece works for make sure that brown people don't get help. She was fairly normal, though my sister and her ex sent her to parochial school in Vancouver, until she went to USC and got her degree in international affairs. It was then that she first worked during the summer for UN Watch, again, an NGO that works to keep Palestine out of the UN, and then NGO Watch. She was going to get her PhD at Columbia, but was so unable to deal with people representing the BDS movement, boycott, divest, and sanctions, that she dropped out and moved to Israel. Even her paternal grandparents, both concentration camp survivors, tried to talk her out of it. It breaks my heart that sweet little girl believes, zealot-like, that she is saving lives by doing her job. There aren't people in my very large extended family, even those barely religious and unfanatical, who think Palestinians have any right to set a foot in Israel. Don't believe... Sorry, I lost track there. Don't believe that BS about Israelis mainly wanting a peaceful two-state solution. Part of it is the Bible BS, where God gave Israel to the Jews, but most of it has to do with the Nazis. Most Jews are so convinced that another Hitler could rise. This includes my idiot family members who voted for Trump. Wow. And the same thing as World War II will happen and no country will let Jews in again. The family doesn't worry about the Klan and their anti-Jewish sentiments. Like I said, many voted for Trump because he's so good for the economy and he's okay because Jared is Jewish and so are the grandkids. If you let Palestinians in, they'll reproduce like crazy and bring all their cousins to Israel and take over the government and kick out the Jews, and then there you are, another Holocaust. I used to hear never again a lot, says Lauren, and heard about the Jews that helped in the civil rights movement in the U.S., but now it seems that never again only applies to the Jews. At my stage of life, I no longer care what my family thinks of me. If they chose their own fanaticism for a country that most of them don't live in over me, so be it. I don't hate Jews. I am a Jew. I do dislike Israelis and those who support their rabid racist government, but the people I know equate dislike of Israel with hatred of Jews, which is not the same thing by any stretch of the imagination. So thank you very kindly for your note, Lauren, and I appreciate your perspective on the issue. And the fact of the matter is, I have argued for a very long time that when you look at a place like southern West Virginia and the hopelessness that obtains there, the joblessness, the disease and the addiction and the torment and the pollution, that whether they realize it or not, people in southern West Virginia have probably more in common with someone in Gaza than they do with someone in California or New York or even Louisiana. There's a reason we call southern West Virginia the sacrifice zone. And in point of fact, like I said, we'll get to the Wednesday stuff shortly, but I saw a story yesterday over at thinkprogress.org, and since there's since the word coal appeared in the title, well, I clicked it and started reading. The title in particular was Paul Krugman Explains Why There's No Future for the Coal Industry. And yeah, I saw that and I thought, ha, this I gotta read. The subheading is, Bringing Back Coal Jobs is About as Practical as Bringing Back the Buggy Whip Industry, explains Krugman. Well, okay. Call me crazy, but I think something has to be gone before you can bring it back. And the coal industry isn't gone in Appalachia. And they're not going to leave unless we force them to leave until they've gotten every last single scrap, every molecule, every jot and tittle, every iota of coal that they can gouge, scrape, dig, blast, poison out of this land. And then I ran into the, then I saw a quote from Paul Krugman. Remember, Paul Krugman's a genius economist, right? He told Think Progress, coal consumption was flat until about 10 years ago. But coal jobs, most of them disappeared anyway because of instead of sending men with picks underground, we were blowing the tops off mountains. It was mostly technology. You see the past tense there? Well, the problem is that that's wrong. Not we were, we are. And it is mostly technology. It's heavy equipment and high explosives. And then he said, in the past decade, fracking hit coal hard. And now, finally, clean energy has come along. Huh, son of a gun. I guess I missed that big announcement from Appalachian Power where they said they'd gone to all wind and solar energy. I guess that explains why they're seeking an 11% rate increase on folks like me and every other customer they have. Well, the things you miss when you're not paying attention. But that being the case, well, if you listen to the program all the way through the credits, you will hear that for something going on probably 10 years or more, at the end of the program every evening, I have, in the credits to the program, I have thanked, and this is a quote, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, the hardest working, bravest people I know. That's not an advertising slogan. That is a statement of conviction upon my part. That's a statement of fact. Because I don't know a whole lot of other people who live right smack dab where the harm is being done, who live with the poisons day in and day out, and at the same time refuse to bow and scrape and kowtow to an industry that, unlike Paul Krugman apparently thinks, isn't fucking gone. And who, for pennies comparatively, stand up to multi-billion-dollar corporations and say that most powerful word in the English language, no. I don't know anybody else doing that. Not around here. Not in Appalachia. And so I thought it would be appropriate, with the Krugman quote and the story in Think Progress, to bring in my dear friend, Vernon Haltom, to talk a little bit about Coal River Mountain Watch's work, and more particularly to talk about that coal river, that mountaintop removal that apparently Paul Krugman and the highfalutin rare thin oxygen set who know which fork to use with the goddamn caviar seems to think is over. Hey, Vernon.
Hey, Bob.
Are we having fun so far? Dirty words notwithstanding, have I pretty much got it?
Yeah, I think so. It's it's news to me about mountaintop removal being over, but it's been news for several years. I think 2015 was back when Alpha declared bankruptcy. We saw a number of news reports, columns, and so forth, saying that King Coal is dead. Mountaintop. There was one that said mountaintop removal is all but ground to a halt. One of our allies. I guess I can use that word. Sent out a fundraising letter in 2016 saying that mountaintop removal is essentially over, and that it's all news to everybody that has these giant sites right over their heads, and as generally, in Appalachia, generally, yes, it's declining, but in some places it's increasing and it's not gone away. And it doesn't heal up like a small scratch. And on Coal River Mountain, Alpha Natural Resources, which is now re-merging with their whatever sprang from their head when they declared bankruptcy, Contour Energy, they're re-merging to be the largest metallurgical coal supplier in the United States. So if every home in the country ran on solar and wind, they would still be going after Coal River Mountain because it is metallurgical coal.
And so, and just so people will understand, and I didn't introduce you properly, I apologize, Vernon. Vernon is the executive director, co-executive director down at Coal River Mountain Watch, and as a consequence, knows the intimate details of exactly what's going on in that area, unlike just about anybody, well, more so than just about anybody outside Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch is named after, well, Coal River Mountain, which was also the topic of a movie some years back that involved Bobby Kennedy Jr. called The Last Mountain. The last mountain in that title was Coal River Mountain, and they are blasting the bejesus out of it even as we speak, right?
I chuckle sometime, I guess, because it's kind of that grim chuckling of, you know, being told that something isn't happening when you see it happening right in front of you.
Gallows humor, I think it's called. Yeah.
Gallows humor, yeah. But what's happening on Coal River Mountain, just to kind of put things in perspective, Alpha Natural Resources has, well, their subsidiaries, because that's, you know, these shell games that they play with their various subsidiaries. But altogether, they have over 6,500 acres of active or pending or idled permits for mountaintop removal and coal sludge dams. That includes the 8 billion gallon Brushy Fork sludge dam. So, you know, that's, I guess that many acres doesn't mean a whole lot unless you're a farmer and can visualize it or what have you. But 640 acres per square mile, that's over 10 square miles. That's if you drive, like if you drive 2 miles one way, then make a right turn and drive 5 miles more, you will have kind of etched out the 10 square miles. So over 10 square miles.
You've got a much better handle on the ciphering than I do, Vernon, so I appreciate that.
It's no problem. but the biggest permit of that is the Eagle II permit. Eagle II is over 2,000 acres. It's 2,040 acres. And, you know, we heard a lot about the Spruce Number 1 permit back in, gosh, it was 2011, I guess, the same year that Judy died. And in 2011, the Spruce Number 1 permit was halted, or at least a part of it was halted. And I believe that was in the neighborhood of 2,000 acres. And, you know, that was hailed as, oh, the biggest mountaintop removal site. And, well, this is at least on that same scale, if not smaller by a few acres or larger by a few acres. But 2,040 acres, that's over 3 square miles. And the funny thing about this permit, well, I'll back up a little bit.
Yeah, funny.
Most of the others have been active for a few years. The Collins Fork Remediation Project is 282 acres of remediating the mountain by blowing it up. And the most recent revision to that is to extend their delay for reclamation and also to turn it into a landfill for their used tires. The 802-acre Middle Ridge permit is directly adjacent to it. You can't tell where one begins and one ends unless you were to plot it out on a map and get your GPS down to the foot and draw a line in the dust. The other one is the 853-acre Long Ridge permit that was approved in December 2016. And so those are very active mountaintop removal sites. The Brushy Fork Sludge Dam is active. It is 645 acres. That's over a square mile of a sludge dam built over old abandoned underground mines. It could break through. You know, we think that's always a possibility because it's done by the same company, Massey Energy, built this thing. Same company that was responsible for the Martin County disaster back in October of 2000. They released over 300 million gallons of toxic black sludge into the Tug Fork and Big Sandy Rivers. Luckily, nobody was killed in that, but I'm getting off on a tangent. So,
well, you've got all the time in the world, and, so, I mean, head down any little mountain road you see fit to, Vernon.
Okay, I was giving a tour to somebody one day, and I had her for 9 hours, and after nine, well, part of that was in a plane, so it's kind of a captive audience, and also in a car giving a tour, and after the 9 hours, oh, you know, I missed something, I forgot to tell her about this. So the next day, I had somebody else for 7 hours. So anyway, I'll try not to be that meandering. So anyway, so you've got these massive mountaintop removal sites. And for people who don't know, mountaintop removal clear cuts the trees, they destroy all the undergrowth, they bulldoze the topsoil, they blast the mountain to pieces, they, in a lot of cases, they push it over into a valley fill. But on Coal River Mountain, you don't have those valley fills. Okay, so this is the newer face of mountaintop removal. And in fact, some people who think that mountaintop removal is over think so because there aren't any new valley fill permits being issued. So on Coal River Mountain, what they're doing is they just push it around a little bit. And so you have this big mess. Let's see. So yeah, it's over 1,000 acres at the head of Workman's Creek, which is above Clear Creek, West Virginia, above Ardy, West Virginia. So folks over along the Clear Fork in Raleigh County, you get to breathe this stuff, okay? And you get it running into your creek, and you suffer the threat of flooding because when you remove all that overgrowth, when you remove the trees, remove the understory, remove the natural contours of the land and replace it with a barren rocky plateau, you have extra runoff. And people have died in this, just downstream of this, back in, I believe it was 98, in the flooding. And in the film Black Diamond, there's one person being interviewed who said that all this water, all this flooding came from the left side. If they do the same to the right side, we're screwed. So this is the right side of that. So if you live in the Clear Fork Valley, this is definitely something to oppose. But they did have plans for, I believe it was like 18 valley fills on the mountain, and those plans have pretty much been set aside because of the new face of mountaintop removal, which means they're pushing it back and forth. So at the head of Workman's Creek, you've got over 1,000 acres, which is the Collins Fork and Middle Ridge permits together, and you've got this freaky little old sludge dam that's 294 acres. It looks like a valley fill, but it's holding back whatever sludge somebody put in there. decades ago, and it's still wet. It's still not dewatered, as the term is. But so you've got all those, and almost just a stone's throw away is Long Ridge Number One permit. That's 853 acres. So you've got all that kind of at the eastern, southeastern portion of the mountain. And you got the Brushy Fork Sledge Dam, that big one, holds about 8 billion gallons right now. And the adjacent Beetree Mountaintop Removal Site, which is idled right now, but it's permitted for over 1,000 acres. And we know that they can crank it up and start doing it again.
At a moment's notice. And you've touched on something here, Vernon. Beetree sits right next to Eagle 2, right?
Beetree sits right next to Brushy Fork Sludge Dam.
Yeah.
And it's also, so Eagle 2, the big one that Alpha is moving into now, will connect the big, massive mountaintop removal at the east end of the mountain to the big, massive sludge dam and mountaintop removal at the west end of the mountain, and form an unbroken line of destruction between the two, cutting off the north and south parts of the mountain. So, I mentioned the blasting. People don't comprehend blasting anymore. They think it's fireworks. If you grew up during the Cold War, you learned a little about these things called nuclear bombs, and that they were bad and they were big. And we used to talk about how in Appalachia we were using the equivalent of a Hiroshima-style nuclear bomb every week. Well, that just doesn't resonate with this generation. So to put things in a little bit better perspective, started using things that they might be more familiar with, like Tomahawk missiles, because we're always blowing somebody up with a Tomahawk missile over in the Middle East. A blast, one of the regular blasts that is common at every day at one site.
Yeah, the kind that I hear and feel miles and miles and miles away here where we are in Fayette County. Yes, just ordinary.
Yeah, just an ordinary, what is considered a small blast by the West Virginia DEP, by the way, on their one of the complaint forms that said a small blast. Well, that small blast was the explosive equivalent of 20 Tomahawk missiles. So
that's a lot of Tomahawk cruise missiles.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's all in one small area and happening every day. And it's above people's homes. So it's not the remote, out in the middle of nowhere thing that the coal industry likes to portray it as. It's right above people's homes. And in the case of Coal River Mountain, there's one little community. It's the McDowell-Holler community, McDowell Branch. I say McDowell because that's the way they pronounce it there. It's spelled like McDowell, like the county. But and so the people there live right under this. They live right under the Middle Ridge permit, which is like a horseshoe around them, with blasting going off there every day. And we've got a drone photo of a blast at the site in pretty close proximity to the homes, but it's all legal. Okay. So I thought, 20 Tomahawk missiles, maybe that's not even the right thing anymore. Well, back in February of 2017, something like that, Donald Trump, or whoever, somebody made the decision to use the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, the Moab, the mother of all bombs. Well, that's the equivalent to about one of these blasts. So imagine having a Moab bomb going off at the head of your holler every Sunday.
And just for clarification, because there's vocabulary that we use here in Appalachia that maybe folks don't use elsewhere. Maybe folks in Arizona or Oregon or California or Minnesota won't know what you mean when you say a holler.
Okay.
What's a holler?
A holler is, well, do you live in a holler, Bob?
Actually, I don't. I live about 2 miles from the holler.
Oh, okay. Well, a holler is a narrow valley. It's a narrow valley with a stream in the middle of it. And a lot of people's homes are there. And I think there's this misconception that people in the mountains build their homes on top of mountains.
Yeah, no.
And that's, no, that doesn't happen. People build it along the rivers, along the streams. So all the communities in West Virginia look like, they're shaped like streams and rivers. So the headwaters of these streams and rivers are where you have the hollers. So they're a narrow valley. You don't, well, as the song goes, and you'll never leave Harlan alive, you know, the sun comes up about 10 in the morning, goes down about 3 in the afternoon. That might be an extra sunny day for some of the folks that, you know, there's some places that never see direct sunlight. But these narrow hollers are where people live, and around them on the ridge tops and working their way down is where they do, the companies do the blasting. And, you know, so you have a kind of a confined area where you have this blasting dust drifting down into the valley. And I encourage everybody to search for On Coal River. It's a film. It's available. The full film is available on YouTube, On Coal River, and watch that, at least the first couple of minutes of it, where Bo Webb has filmed, you know, the blasting dust coming down on him, and they're at the head of a holler where he and his cousin had a garden right above his cousin's house. Well, that cousin died last week.
Cancer.
Of cancer. Of course, like everybody dies of cancer in the area. It's, you know, I used to say, tell people, don't say it's as common as the cold, but I've stopped saying that because it is. So, and if you are 57, 58, 59 years old and live near mountaintop removal, there's a good chance that you're going to get it and die from it within a few months. But
hey,
know,
Vernon,
then,
let's take a couple of seconds and let me just roll the audio from the beginning of On Coal River so that folks can know what you're talking about. Again, if you just go to YouTube and you go to On Coal River full movie, it's right there. It's an hour and 21 minutes long, and you will be ever so glad that you watched this. Not because it's going to make you happy, but because you'll know a little bit more about what corporate America does to ordinary, average, everyday American citizens. Because, yes, oddly enough, hillbillies are Americans, too. And just by way of a setup, this is at the head of a holler. You can see what a holler looks like because you can see the mountain ridges descending and folding in on each other to form the head of the holler. So the voice you're about to hear is someone with whom Vernon and I work on a regular basis, Bo Webb. And this was not staged, right, Vernon? I mean, this just happened.
There are two, actually two parts to that. One where you see the blast go off from a distance. Okay, and that was where Bo and a photographer had set up their camera across the valley. I mean, not even in the holler, but across the valley. A mile away, something like that. And then you see another portion of that where the blast came from the same area, but Bo was up in the garden that day. He just happened to have his whatever recording device they were up there doing work in the garden, and the blast went off. So you don't see the blast go off there, but you see the dust as it billows over the sun and starts coming down the holler a little bit.
Right.
Look, there it is. There it is. Now, where's it going to come? Right down on top of us. Look at that. Look at the sun now.
That's silica, Danny. That's silica. Oh, man, you smell it now?
Look here. Look here. Look here. Look at this. We live here.
And that's the point, Vernon. You know, you might say, if you didn't know better, well, get out of there. Well, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah, it's kind of like telling a Palestinian to leave Palestine.
Yeah.
Why do you still live there? Just go. But, it's, yeah, so that's what happens regularly. You know, that dust is deadly. And in the film, Bo points out that it is silica. It's mostly silica. There are a few other things. But, you know, the industry wants to say that, well, this is just dust, it's harmless, you know, it blows away, or as the way the DEP phrases it, it dissipates. But people breathe it, and they breathe it every day, and a lot of times you can't even see it because of the ultrafine particles that may drift for miles and miles. And, you know, we've known for, gosh, a good century probably, that silica dust is hazardous to your health. That's what killed people in Oxnard. So silica is bad for you. It's known to be bad for you. And there's this myth that Appalachian people are somehow immune. They've evolved some sort of immunity to silica dust and immunities to lead and iron and various things in the water. And, you know, in West Virginia, apparently the laws of physics, biology, and chemistry in the United States don't apply. So, which brings me to the laws of the United States that don't seem to apply in West
either.
Virginia.
Right.
Right. So, the Eagle II permit, just to back up just a little bit, so everybody knows, this is not, you know, the health impacts are not some sort of abstract concept. They're not some sort of, well, this could happen or this might happen. It is happening. People die every day from mountaintop removal, and it seems like we don't go more than a few months without hearing of somebody else dying. And the health studies have piled up. I mean, there are over 2 dozen, probably around 30 or so health studies pointing to mountaintop removal, most of them pointing to the dust coming off the two sites. And, well, the whole National Academy of Sciences study that was canceled last year because, gosh, hey, we don't want to know about this. You know, if we don't know about it, it won't hurt us. So the ACAC, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, aims to stop mountaintop removal by addressing the health impacts. And I won't even go into all those details because right now I'm getting off on this tangent, but people die from it, and it's not abstract. Bo is my father-in-law. For folks who don't know, Bo is my father-in-law. And his wife died of this, of mountaintop removal in 2013. And that's a punch in the gut to everybody who knows somebody who dies of this. And then everybody else wonders who's going to be next. You know, who is going to be next? It's almost like you see the Grim Reaper coming down the road. Which house is he going to stop at next? So So it's not an emotionless issue. It's not an abstract issue or a concept that could or might happen if something goes wrong, because mountaintop removal is conducted the way it's planned to do, and people die as a result. So on Coal River Mountain, you've got this 3-square-mile mountaintop removal site that Alpha has begun mining on. This is where the laws of the United States don't seem to apply in West Virginia. Federal law says that if you don't start your permit, if you don't start working on your surface mine permit within 3 years, the permit shall terminate.
And not may, not might. Shall.
Not should, not could, not, yeah, any kind of Dr. Seuss terminology you can muster there doesn't redefine shall, which means that it shall, not, like you said, not may or might. Well, so that permit was issued in 2008. There were a bunch of permits issued in 2008. For some reason, there seemed to be a rush to get all these permits issued in 2008. And it didn't start. It didn't start. 2011 came and went, and one of our staff members said, hey, you know, here's this clause in the law that says if it doesn't start within 3 years, it shall terminate. Hey, let's complain to the West Virginia DEP. We complained to the West Virginia DEP. West Virginia DEP said, oh, gosh. Hey, Alpha, well, at that time it was Massey. No, it wasn't. It was Alpha by then, because Alpha bought Massey in 2011. And this is 2012. We need you to ask for an extension on this, and we'll give it to you. So they asked for an extension, and they gave it to them. Not for any of
let's not blaze past that. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, which is supposed to be a neutral arbiter of environmental safety, looked and saw an expired mountaintop removal permit and said to Massey Energy, or Alpha as the case may be, hey, y'all need to re-up this thing. And the corporation, the coal company, said, huh, mercy sakes, look at us. I do believe we've forgotten our fudge. And I mean, that part alone is dirty, is it not?
It's dirty because it's after them. I mean, apparently they have some kind of procedures, administrative procedures, where they're supposed to contact the company prior to the termination and remind them that that's coming up. So they retroactively did that. Alpha requested the extension, and West Virginia DEP granted it, not for any of the very few limited reasons that that one of these permits can be extended. There are a few reasons that a permit can be extended. None of those reasons applied. So we said, hey, that's not cool. And we complained to the Charleston Field Office of the Federal Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. And I'll just call them OSM for short, save a couple syllables there. So OSM looked at it and agreed with us. They said, the permit's terminated. But you can appeal to our higher-ups. And West Virginia DEP did that appeal. And it skipped a level, apparently, and went straight to Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C., I'm not sure how quickly they issued this decision, but the head office of OSM said, you know, the word shall doesn't carry a mandatory requirement.
So, you know, except in the dictionary.
Except in the dictionary in any law case that's ever happened. So you're good to go. You know, your permit is, you know, West Virginia DEP's extension of that was not arbitrary, capricious, and an abuse of discretion. So you're good to go. Well, we found out about it because there was a similar case in Alaska where a citizens group was opposing the retroactive extension of a not started permit. And OSM's decision was used in that case, and somehow we got wind of it. You know, nobody ever told us until we asked. But so we saw the determination, and that's not good. So we sued OSM, and in December of 2016, mind you, this is over eight years after the permit was first issued, over 5 years after it should have terminated, the OSM in court, in D.C., in federal court, said they moved to vacate and remand that bad decision to reconsider it in light of the Alaska case, because parallel to our lawsuit, the Alaska case was won by the citizens groups, where federal judge said shall means shall, and those permits are permits terminated. So the federal judge in D.C. ordered, you know, they agreed with the vacature and remand, and ordered OSM to reconsider their bad decision expeditiously. And that was December 2016. So in my mind, in everything, here we are a year and a half later, this hasn't been expeditious. And they haven't come to a decision yet, at least none that they're willing to tell anybody about. But in the meantime, Alpha has begun mining without a valid permit on a 2,000-acre mountaintop removal site.
So it's literally an outlaw. It's literally an outlaw operation.
It's literally an outlaw operation, and they have the gall to put up no trespassing signs and serve our outreach coordinator with papers telling him not to trespass. But even though this mountain
And to be clear, they don't own the mountain. They rented it from a land company, right?
Yeah, they lease it from Roland Land Company is the main one up there. And they don't own it, but they think they do. And they treat everybody in the community as if the whole mountain is theirs, and everybody, families have gone back generations hunting and digging ramps and ginseng and picking Molly Mutra mushrooms and picking berries and hiking and building cabins in the woods and what have you, everything that Appalachian people do on this mountain. Say, no, you can't do this anymore because this is ours. You know, this belongs to somebody in Bristol, and this belongs to somebody on Wall Street, you know, the shareholders. And it's just wrong. It is wrong that they're, you know, it's kind of at the very beginning of the site, and we've been watching them get closer and closer. And what they've done in preparation is they've gotten revisions to the neighboring permits, so that the what the industry calls overburden, what used to be mountain from this site, from Eagle 2, will just get pushed over onto Middle Ridge and Collins Fork. So. It's infuriating that the DEP is treating this as if it's a valid permit. The coal company is treating it as if it's a valid permit. And we disagree.
We're not disagreeing simply because we don't like it. We're disagreeing because it appears that the actual facts and the law and the circumstances are all in our favor. And as
you would think so, yeah.
Yeah. But there's also a history, and we would be remiss, I think, if we didn't mention this, because it plays into why the coal industry has gotten away with as much as it did. We have a history of taking things to court and then having them get killed. It's not capital punishment in the sense of, you know, somebody getting strapped to a horizontal crucifix and injected with drugs. But there have been death warrants signed by federal judges to let the coal industry go ahead and do what it does to the detriment of the health, well-being, and even life of the people who live here. So, you know, while we think we're right, the courts have not always...
Well, yeah, and, you know, even by the time it gets to a court, in a lot of cases, the damage has been done. And we've seen in the past where, you know, the company pushes a few rocks into a stream and says, hey, you know, there's no further harm to be done to whoever's bringing whatever suit. And judges are like, it's kind of like once you eat that cookie from the cookie jar, you get the whole jar with no slap on the wrist. And in the case on Coal River Mountain, the case is really all one big glob of a case. Alpha has a history of violations, and you know that's part of what our TIP project has been focused on, the Coal River Intensive Monitoring Project, is to find violations, report them, follow up, and try to get some of these sites stopped. That strategy worked for the KD number 2 mountaintop removal site, which is right next to Pinal State Forest. It worked for them because they could test the water every day. They could go to the site every day. It was literally a walk in the park to go to the site. They just have to turn left instead of right or right instead of left on one of the hiking trails at the park, and you're there. On Coal River Mountain, it's not that easy. It involves a trek of several miles on an ATV, and the company has done things like digging trenches through the trail to prevent access. They've piled boulders on the trail to prevent access. And it's difficult to monitor. And it's bigger, it's more remote. The company is much bigger with a lot more power. And you know, getting the numbers of violations that would warrant the West Virginia DEP to actually terminate a permit has been, we've still got a long ways to go there. But, you know, keeping an eye on them and reporting them is something that we feel we need to do pretty much constantly to both inform and supplement any legal action that may be contemplating.
Well, somebody needs to, and that's largely fallen to Coal River Mountain Watch.
And, well, we are Coal River Mountain Watch, so we should watch Coal River Mountain.
Exactly, but not just Coal River Mountain. We've watched a lot of other mountains as well, and watched some of them be destroyed irretrievably. But you've described a ton of work, Vernon. You've talked about drones. You've talked about going up on sites to monitor and keep track. You've talked about permit reviews, court challenges. I mean, an organization that can do all that must have like $1 million annual budget, right?
Our entire our entire organizational budget is less than the salary of Sierra Club's executive director.
Let's say that again. The entire operational budget of Cold River Mountain Watch is less than the annual salary of the executive director of the Sierra Club. Did I hear that right?
Yes. Yes.
There's a whole lot of...
It's not even, his is nearly $250,000, but there are other executive directors in West Virginia of other groups whose annual salary is approximately our entire annual budget, which includes all our travel, all our all our supplies, our mortgage, our salaries for our four staff.
And the multitude of projects that you run. You mentioned crimp.
I mean,
you mentioned crimp. There's tadpole. There's creek. There's ache. Is there any organization out there doing so much with so little?
Well, we love our acronyms, so we've also got SEED.
I forgot about SEED. Sorry.
And STEEP. Don't forget STEEP.
Yes.
But we seem to be kind of holistically approaching this. We're doing what we can to be standing up against the bad stuff. I'm reminded of the old poster that somebody hung on their wall back in the 70s, where you've got this mouse flipping off an eagle swooping down at him. We feel like we're that mouse flipping off that.
Yeah, the last great act of defiance, I think that was called.
Yeah. And so we do that, but we also do what we can to improve the community. Because, we want to have something left. We want to not be a toxic, dusty wasteland where it's hopeless and nobody has a job and all that. And you mentioned the Tadpole Project. The Tadpole Project, it's kind of funny that we get a grant we've been getting a grant every year for the past 4 or 5 years from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, the same overall agency that we butt heads against, but there are different divisions within DEP. And some of them are actually good folks. A lot of them are good folks trying to do a good job. And but that's a tiny little budget, and we can only use a tiny little bit of it for salaries. But it's a very labor-intensive project that involves picking up trash from the creeks and the hollers and the river and the roadsides and cleaning up cemeteries in the community. And that's a lot of work. It's a lot of sweat. It's a lot of labor. And, we do organize community members to get involved, have a little picnic after the trash is picked up, and on pleasant days, maybe take a dip in the river and fish or what have you. But there's a lot to be picked up. I mean, this area has been neglected and abused for so long, and it seems like just when the folks that do the hardest work, Debbie Gerald and Peggy Bone, are the folks heading up and organizing the Tadpole Project, once they get one spot picked up, somebody comes in a week or two later and throws out more trash. So it's, that's an uphill battle, but after 10 years of the Tadpole Project, it's finally starting to show some significant results, where, people can have a pleasant hike or go fishing or go swimming and not worry that, they're going to get tangled up in a wad of barbed wire or have a dirty diaper float past them. But, and the Tadpole Project includes CREEK, which you mentioned, Coal River Environmental Education for Kids. West Virginia has the worst health the country. It always ranks last in the well-being of the Gallup health wage poll. And we also have high incidence of childhood obesity and a lot of hopelessness. But CREAT gives kids something fun to do. You know, sometimes it involves picking up trash and picking up junk. But it gives them a sense of pride in the community, a sense of pride in community service, some conservation ethic. You know, if you want to swim here and fish here and float down the river in your inner tube or kayak here or whatever, you need to take care of it and don't let somebody mess it up. And so they go on field trips. You know, they learn about their the history of the area from going to some of the things like the Beckley Exhibition coal mine, the Whipple Company store. They go on scavenger hunts at Grandview State Park. They go on free fishing days to a little Beaver State Park. They've got a thing coming up, I think, this Saturday at Tank Creek that they're going to attend, the Kids Day. And gives the kids something to do, something other than sitting around playing video games and sitting around being hopeless and despairing. And they, gosh, the things that they learn, they've learned first aid, they've learned how to make a fire, they've learned how, you know, what plants are what, and they've learned about benthic macroinvertebrates and, you know, how to tell the health of a stream by what kind of bugs are living in it. And that's something that, you know, we're passing on to the next generations to, because, you know, people don't want to just leave. You know, the just leave idea is something that people need to stop saying. There was a county commissioner's wife, old Judy Bonds, that at a thing that we went to in Kentucky one time. She said, well, if you don't like it, why don't you just leave? And man, it's just dang good that somebody else is sitting next to Judy when she said that, because I probably would have encouraged her to come across the table. But anyway,
I know.
So nobody wants to just leave. And so there's that. We've got the SEED project, Sustainable Energy and Economic Diversification. So this year we're raising a half acre of industrial hemp. We're going to be harvesting the buds for cannabidiol and demonstrating that, look, here's something that you can do here in West Virginia that you don't have to blow the mountains up to do. You don't have to poison the water. You don't have to kill your neighbors to do this. This is something, if you've got a little patch of land, you can make some money off of it. And that's not abstract. I mean, there are people raking hemp in West Virginia. There aren't that many hemp farmers in West Virginia, so the growth potential, you know, in every sense of the word is huge. So we're going to demonstrate that. We've just gotten this winter and spring, we've gotten solar panels installed at the Judy Bond Center, our office and visitor lodging and so forth at in Naoma, the Judy Bond Center for Appalachian Preservation, where our office is. So with enough
solar, and just so folks can know,
all our electricity.
Just so folks can know, Judy died of mountaintop removal too.
Yes, she did. And it was her illness prompted, as much as anything prompted, extra work focusing on the health issues and prompted a campaign. It's heartbreaking that she was killed. You know, it wasn't, oh, she just got sick and died. She was killed. And everybody else I know that died at mountaintop removal was killed. As certainly as if Mr. Stetson or whoever the, well, I guess at that time it would have been Don Bland. Certainly as if somebody put a gun to their head and blown them up. I say blow them up. Joseph Mallard mentioned on Blankenship, I'm thinking of Big Branch. Upper Big Branch, for folks who don't know, is only about 10 minutes away from our office. That's where 29 miners were killed. They didn't just die, they just killed over and died. They were killed on April 10th April 5th of the year 2010. And the CEO of the company at the time, Ron Blankenship, was eventually found guilty of a misdemeanor of conspiring to violate safety regulations and sent to prison for a year. And then he just unsuccessfully ran for U.S. Senator from West Virginia. But he's got a lot of supporters. But I'm getting off on one of those side roads.
Happens.
So it does. And it's hard not to, because everything is so so related. It's like all callers are all connected. And, you know, when you get down to the mouth of the hollow,
the little stream runs into the creek, and the creek runs into the, and the next thing you know, it's the Ohio River.
Yeah, and that's kind of the way we are. We've got all these tributaries of things that we do that feed into our mission of ending mountaintop removal, improving the quality of life in our area, and helping rebuild sustainable communities. So we've got those things. We've got STEEP. You know, I'm always having fun with acronyms. The Show and Tell Energy Education and Policy Project. And what that does, it kind of incorporates what we were calling the roadshow for so long, where we go and speak at colleges and rallies and speaking events. And we host journalists, we host student groups, we give tours to lots of folks. I guess we need to start counting them. But Junior, we spent 30 days gone this spring speaking to, you know, at little colleges and so forth. And it's just really frustrating to see some of the videos and some of the presentation of those talks where he's talking about the largest metallurgical coal company in the country blowing up the mountains above his home, blowing up his home essentially, because Coal River Mountain is his home, and killing the people who live below, and needing support for that, and we need to stop this, on the same stage with people who are starting recycling programs and things like that. And college students, bless their hearts, they just don't seem to be as radical as they used to be.
But that's another thing that Coal River Mountain Watch has done, Vernon. Is there any way of calculating the number of students that Coal River Mountain Watch has hosted over the years and made mountaintop removal real for them, helped it to become something more than an esoteric issue far, far away? Because it's got to be in the thousands.
If you count both the students that we've hosted, because we host all spring break, students come from Connecticut, New York, Florida, and add that to the students that have been spoken to at their college and what have you, I'd say yes, it is in the thousands. And in fact, one year, gosh, I think it was 10,000 that junior spoke at. It was the I remember the name of the big one that
Power Shift.
Sorry, is this Power Shift? Yeah, and you know there have been, you know, I 10,000 there, and you know, the one time that Junior spoke at Power Shift, I think he may have had 10 minutes on the stage. Al Gore had 30 minutes or an hour, however long he takes. But you know, Judy spoke at Power Shift, and I think Kim DeChristopher spoke at Power Shift 1 year and said that if everybody there were to walk on the Coal River Mountain and refuse to leave, you know, however many per day, 20 per day, for that long extended period, that it would end. And it probably would, you know, if there was some way to motivate and mobilize that many people. You know, Tim and Christopher spent, what was it, a year or two or three in prison for bidding, whereas Don Blankenship got a year in prison for killing 29 people. So that's, you know, that kind of
sticks in your craw a little bit.
Sure.
And then, of course, all those other acronyms, people, you know, the members of the Horn Family Community Congregation probably know the most about the Ake campaign because of the amount of time that I've spent away from the microphone, you know, going to D.C. and working on it and so forth.
And that's really, you know, the Ake campaign, it's like when you and Bo go to D.C., for the Ake campaign, it's like Frodo and Sam going to Mordor to throw the ring in the pit, in the lava, so that mountaintop removal can end, so that we can kill it at its source. But I guess you need a golem to go along with you, so he can jump in.
Well, we're damn sure short of a Gandalf at this point, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, I've been growing the beard out, so trying there.
We got to get to the funny hat, though.
I had one of those, but it keeps showing up on press pictures of me, so I need to stop. So I need to post a different picture of
me. Yeah, and we need to get a picture of you, me, and Bo, and a little speech bubble coming out of your mouth saying "Fly, you fools." but
I've got a picture of me and Bo and Junior in Washington D.C. with the Capitol behind us, and it's like getting Junior into a suit. It's almost like, man, that was tough.
Well, I think it requires an act of Congress and a bumper jack, doesn't it?
Yeah, because you know Junior's an Appalachian guy who likes to be outdoors. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to be lobbying and. But, you know, he's been thrust into this public speaking role since 2009 at one of the Environmental Council's, West Virginia Environmental Council's E-Day, Environmental Day at the Capitol back in, I think, or pretty sure it was 2009. And it's like, somebody speak, hey, Junior, come here. And got him up there, and he hasn't shut up since. So that's a good thing. But in the meantime, you know, we got the Ake campaign. We got... I forget exactly how many U.S. House representatives are signed on. It's in the 20s, I believe, and need to get it introduced into the Senate. Part of the challenge is that it seems like every few days there's some other crazy thing going on in the world that the U.S. government is at the heart and center of, showing pain and discord throughout the world. So the folks at home in Appalachia are kind of forgotten because of that, you know. And so it's like what's going on in Mordor. That's kind of where a lot of the fight is. And back in the Shire, you've got people, you know, keeping an eye on the advancing horde of orcs that are blowing them up. But
yeah, and Grima Wormtongue is the governor.
Yeah, exactly. I guess
I had to work for that one.
Yeah, you did. But man, he does a good job.
But you know, with where the Ake campaign is concerned, one of the more frustrating, the whole reason the Ake campaign came into being is because. For a lot of years, and you were one of them, I was one of them, Bo was one of them, Judy was one of them, that we'd look to these outside groups who were supposed to have all the answers and be ever so smart, certainly smarter than us hillbillies. And we'd say, why haven't you proposed a law to end this?
Well, you know, Bob, we've thought about that, but we've determined that now just isn't the time to ask Congress to stop killing the hillbillies. Maybe the political climate will improve in a year or two, and then we'll spend $50,000 on a conference where we'll talk about whether we should schedule a meeting to ponder a debate on whether or not we should think about a bill that might end this problem.
And that was years until finally we looked up and said, you know, screw it. I guess we're going to have to do it. And that was the beginning of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. And again, you know, it's one of those running along on fumes, you know, the old Jackson Brown song, running on empty. And the most frustrating aspect of all that, Vernon, is regardless of what program, what project it is that we're talking about that Coal River Mountain Watch is engaged in, we know what we could do if there was, you know, adequate funding with which to do it. And meanwhile, as you said, there are groups out there who have executive directors making more money in 1 year than the entire budget of Coal River Mountain Watch. And so, with that having been said, what I suggest, or not suggest, well, look, Coal River Mountain Watch is a 501c3 tax-exempt charitable organization. So whatever you give to Coal River Mountain Watch is tax deductible. And to that end, you know, at one point in time, I had this crazy notion in my head that maybe I'd go out west and just try to start in San Diego and start talking to groups all the way up to Seattle and Vancouver. You know, take a month or two to do it, with the idea of just trying to get people to sign on at $10 a month, $20 a month, just to become sustaining supporters, so that we can do what it is that we are, and I say we, I don't do much of it, y'all do the heavy lifting, but so that Coal River Mountain Watch can do what it is very, very good at, what it has a track record of being good at. And so folks can go to crmw.net, right? And there's a donation, there's a donation page, there's a donation button right there.
Right. Yeah, that's the easy way to do it, crmw.net, and, you know, put a donation button at the top of each site, so you know, if you miss one, you're more likely to hit the other. So, and that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand about trickle-down philanthropy. You know, people sign up for $10 a month or $20 a month to a big organization that has layers of hierarchy and an organizational chart that looks like a wiring diagram for a computer, and expect that is going to trickle down to the grassroots, and it doesn't. I mean, if you want to water the grassroots, if you want to nurture the grassroots, give to the grassroots, and you don't get any more grassrootsy or front lines than Coal River Mountain Watch. I mean, I think we're the only group that has a photo of our office, a mountaintop removal site, and a sludge dam all in the same shot. That's how front lines we are. When the blasts go off, we feel it. When the wind blows and the breeze carries the dust to our staff and board and everybody else in the community, and it's not a know, it is right there. It is grassroots and it is front lines. And, you know, there was some article published a few years back that, you know, that is the most effective use of the donation dollars. Give directly to the grassroots. Don't give to, you know, I'm not trying to deprive anybody of their $250,000 salary, but, you know, give to the grassroots. Don't give, well, if you want to give to the 1%, go ahead. But it's not really going to trickle down. I mean, we get some help from some other major groups, but it's, well, it's insufficient to do what we need. And, you know, we have enough on our plate that we could hire 20 people. If we had the money, we could hire 20 people and keep them busily occupied every day. You know, we were up to 14 at one point. Everybody was busy every day. And those days have gone because mountain top removal is no longer on the front page of school board journal. It's no longer in Vanity Fair. It's no longer on evening news because there are so many other things that are getting people's attention that need help too. You know,
it doesn't help when the Paul Krugmans of the world sit down to talk with Think Progress, which is read by a lot of progressive liberal people, and says we were blowing the tops off of mountains. I mean, that got all over me yesterday, Vernon.
Yeah, well, because it's hard. We were earlier today. Is it sundown yet?
Not here.
Okay, well, after
I'm not up a holler, though.
You can say we were blowing the mountains up earlier today. But unless it's between sundown and sunrise, we are blowing them up. We are, you know, everybody's got a hand in it. And, you know, the solar and the wind, those are great things. You know, we should definitely.
Well, and Coal River Mountain Watch is walking the walk and talking the talk because Coal River Mountain Watch has installed solar.
But also recycle your steel cans, you know. Gosh, cut down on the use of steel.
I mean, we collect old tires to keep them from, again, we. CRMW collects old tires to keep them out of the streams. And disposes of them.
Yeah, over 1,000 every year. But that's, you know, but those things are all, you know, there are people who would like to think that changing your light bulb is all you got to do. And that recycling your can is all you got to do. And the solution to all these problems is just better behavior by individuals and better choices. And that's not the case. You know, we got to end this stuff. We got to fight mountaintop removal because it's mountaintop removal and killing people. We got to pass the AIC Act. We got to get these permits, you know, one by one, terminated or stopped in some way or form or fashion, because a mountaintop removal permit is just a death factory that produces coal as a byproduct.
In exchange for vast corporate profits.
Oh, yeah, big corporate profits for somebody who will never have to breathe the dust. Somebody who will probably never even set foot in the state in a lot of cases. And, you know, bless their hearts, a lot of the people like the Paul Krugmans of the world and well-meaning organizations that advise and advocate for us don't really have any skin in the game. You know, for the most part, you know, Paul Krugman, like you had mentioned, didn't he ask somebody who's actually there? Well, like, we feel like we've seen Horton, Here's a Who, where Horton, this big elephant, is the only one who can hear this tiny little world of people on a speck of dust on a clover flower. We feel like we're the Who's, and we're here. And the Who's, our whole world is on the brink of being tossed into a bubbling vat of hot oil and killing them all until, well, you have all the Who's saying, we're here, we're here, we're here, until finally little Cindy Lou Who, her final little voice is, we're here, and then the other animals can hear the Who's and know that they are there. They exist, and don't throw them into the vat of boiling oil. And, you know, we keep thinking he's going to be our little Cindy Lou Who. You know, I thought back in 2004, I thought it would be Jeremy Davidson. For folks who don't know, little Jeremy Davidson is 3 years old, asleep in his bed, all tucked in and cozy. At 2 a.m, a boulder pushed off the mountain by A&G Coal Company killed him in his bed. And we thought that would, maybe this would bring some attention to it. But instead, we saw the coal company turning out their...
yeah, they got fined $15,000 for that.
$15,000.
And they appealed it. And they appealed it.
They appealed it. And they turned out people ranting and raving about how changing that law or any more stringent requirements and so forth would put them all out of a job. It would ruin the economy of the area. Everybody would be freezing in the dark and all that. None of that came to pass. Jeremy Davidson is still dead. And how many other little kids now have died from mountaintop removal? Even, you know, first effects, mountaintop removal is associated with a 42% higher rate of first effects. It is unconscionable that people who rant and rave about being pro-life think it's fine and dandy to poison little Appalachian babies in the womb and have them born with a heart defect or a lung defect or hyperplastic left heart, HLHS, hyperplastic left heart syndrome, where part of your heart is severely underdeveloped, and you have three little babies born between Trap Hill and Horse Creek, a stretch of, oh, I don't know, 15 miles, something like that, if that, you know, population of not even 5,000, three little babies born with a disease that hits one in 100,000 live births. And, you know, the common denominator, their mothers went to Marsh Fork Elementary School.
Which sits next to a coal prep plant, which sits below a mountaintop removal site and 2.8 billion gallons of toxic waste.
Yeah, and, you know, Marsh Fork Elementary School, that was a victory for Cold River Mountain Watch after years of, it was a six-year campaign to finally get a new school approved in a safe location. In the meantime, all those years, you know, kids were breathing this dust every day. You couldn't deny it. I mean, they even, you know, during Upper Big Branch disaster, when all the world's media descended on Marsh Fork Elementary, and when it was spring break, had it not been spring break, so the kids would have been, they would have heard their daddies being killed in a mine that exploded. It's that close. But it was spring break, and all the press in the world descended on it. Well, one of the CNN reporters noted that you can go into the school and wipe your hand across nearly anything, and it comes off black with coal dust. And coal dust is just one of the things that the kids are exposed to. But after 6 years, in 2010, we finally got approval. That's another long story, because the state wasn't going to approve it. It took a generous philanthropist who came to visit the community and get tours and see mountaintop removal and see the school and all that. It took him to actually make that happen, because the state was not going to make it happen. Joe Manchin was not going to make it happen. But we finally got the kids a safe new school in a location that just happens to be 2 miles from the Eagle Tooth permit.
And that was what I was going to say next. And now they are mountaintop removing over top of that school.
Yes.
Well, let me go in one other direction. You know, you talked about the trying to show that there are sustainable ways of living in the Coal River Valley and in the sacrifice zone of southern West Virginia and central Appalachia generally. I criticized Paul Krugman, and I think justifiably so. But later in the interview, he says, so coal is not coming back. The question should be, what can we do for what used to be coal country, not what can we do to bring coal jobs back, because that's about as practical as bringing back the buggy whip industry. And the bottom line here is that employment has declined not primarily because of the decline of coal, but because of mechanization. Okay? And it's the same with a lot of heavy industry. It takes fewer people to build cars now than it did in 1920 because of mechanization and efficiencies and robots and so forth. There are mines in Australia where the great big humongous dump trucks are run by wire. You know, they're basically drone trucks. And you know, that's where the coal industry wants to go. They want to eventually get to 100% profit and 0% labor. That's always been their goal. But he says coal's not coming back, Vernon, but you can't say coal's not coming back until coal is gone. It's almost like Krugman believes the unmitigated bullshit that was the Obama EPA war on coal. We all know that was a lie. But the fact of the matter is, you mentioned way at the beginning of the conversation, all the permits that got issued in 2008. Well, that was in anticipation either of a Republican victory by John McCain, in which case it would have been Katie bar the door, or they wanted to get all their permits because they thought that Obama would somehow stop them. Now, to be fair, and I think we just have to do this, the Obama administration did little or nothing to curtail mountaintop removal, and they did little to nothing to actually slow the production of coal. So, I mean, that's a part of all of this, but there's one element of what Krugman says that has the ring of honesty. What can happen to make this a viable economy and a viable ecosystem in at the same time? Because there's a lot of big thinking that goes on around that, and the term just transition gets bandied about quite a bit. Any thoughts on your part there?
Yeah, I get asked that something along those lines fairly often. Sometimes people say, "Well, how are you going to replace all of these coal jobs?" And you know, I even had a friend, a well-meaning friend, one time say, "Well, how can you talk about ending mountaintop removal until you first talk about replacing the jobs?" I'm like, what jobs? What jobs? Mountaintop removal employs way less than 1% of West Virginia's workforce. What jobs are you talking about? That guy or that guy over there? Or that one over there driving that truck? oh, that guy over there with the explosives. Oh, and the security guy that's coming to tell us we need to leave. You know, mountain top removal ends jobs. It eliminates jobs. The coal industry itself employs less than 5% of West Virginia's workforce. And that was a few years ago when they had more employees than they do now. But, I mean, it's on this decline, but it doesn't decline to zero. And the reporter at West Virginia, the Charleston Gazette, Ken Ward, some years back published this chart that shows this. It's like a 45-degree angle of this coal decline, and then it levels off. Well, it doesn't level off at zero. And we're getting kind of close to, you know, time-wise to the leveling off. But that still means that there's still going to be mountaintop removal. There's still going to be underground mining. There's still going to be, for the longest time, most metallurgical coal was extracted by underground mining. But, you know, we still have that lingering industry. It's not dead, and it's mean. It's a very mean industry. For a couple of years there, when we had what's called an informal conference, which is basically a public hearing where you come out, where citizens get to come out and express their opposition to a permit to the West Virginia DEP. We get this chance, you know, from the time that it's advertised in the paper, we get like we're supposed to advertise it for 4 consecutive weeks, and then the end of the comment period is 30 days after the end of that. So we get about maybe 2 months of comment period. And at some point along the way, we get a conference where we get to say to them directly, no, you can't do this. For a long time, the companies only sent a minimal number of people to those. I mean, we used to have the big, they changed format where now you sit down and speak into a recorder, and at the other end of the room, you've got DEP folks trying to answer questions or giving lies, as the case might be. Some really funny things. Oh, my goodness. But anyway, so they became less of a heated opportunity. And the coal companies stopped sending masses of people out. They'd send, you know, a couple of guys, maybe an engineer, supervisor or something. The last one where we had advertised and publicized this hearing, where the coal company wants to extend their time for reclamation. That means leave the place a dusty mess longer than they would have otherwise, you know, extend the time it takes to spray some hydro seed on it. And, you know, actually in violation of the law, if you want to break a law, you just ask for West Virginia DEP if you can, and they say, okay, go ahead. So that's part of it. And they also wanted to turn the site into a landfill for their used tires. And my goodness, people showed up and the parking lot was filled with company trucks, filled with angry miners, hundreds of people in their stripes, hundreds of angry miners in their stripes. I call them angry miners because I was told it's some sort of venting session some years ago that I shouldn't call them coal hubs. But so
they're probably all suffering from economic anxiety. Yes,
economic anxiety, because they're told that they're going to lose their job if this revision is not granted. So keep this in mind, Bob. here are people who are, whether they were paid for their time or coerced into their time, of you better get out there and express your desire to keep your job and support this revision, are fighting for their job by fighting against the work. It's kind of like, you know, I got to go take a crap again in a few hours, so I'm not going to wipe now. Let's just not do
that. Oh, my God. Yeah, it is.
You know, that's...
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. But they actually believe, some of them actually believe, whether they, I guess some of them believe it, that's what they say, that it would end their, you know, that... they're fighting for their jobs. Well, to me, doing something that requires work and getting paid to do it is a job. But the company doesn't want to do that. They don't want to pay somebody to do that work. And these guys are fighting for the company. They say they're fighting for their jobs, but they're fighting for the company ability to not have those jobs.
Right, they're fighting for the company
and the reclamation
and against themselves. You know, one of the things that I've had running, and I'm, you know, I get ideas all the time. But if we had something on the level of the Depression era CCC, only with a lot more money, when you consider the number of mountaintop removal sites that have not been reclaimed within the meaning of the law, which is like 97% of them, if we had a federal program that paid commensurate salaries and benefits and health care, we could put every mountaintop removal worker to work and then some, just cleaning up the messes that the mountaintop removal industry made in the first place and didn't adequately clean up. And those people would be, but the people of the industry would have full employment for a generation. That is, if we had a responsive government that took its obligation to Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee seriously.
And you know, that is, you know, one of the things that Judy Bonds used to say is, look, the guy doesn't even have to get off the bulldozer. Just turn it around. But what we've seen instead is reclamation being drawn out for years and years. The Ed White permit, the 2,000-acre mountaintop removal site above the old Marsh Fork Elementary and above our office. It was idled and, gosh, it's been, I want to say, 2 years at least. And it was supposed to have been cleaned up. It was supposed to have been reclaimed within 180 days of the last bit of coal being removed. And this is now how many years later, and it's still not done. So there are those jobs that those guys can do. And keep in mind that that's only a very small fraction of West Virginia's workforce. They need something to do. West Virginia needs something to do. Appalachia needs something to do. Appalachians can grow hemp. They can, maybe do some value-added things with ginseng, or, you know, we hosted an herbal thing from with visitors talking about, you know, value-added stuff with ginseng and other things. But there are a lot of things that can be done, but Appalachia continues to be treated as a resource, as an extraction state, as Joe Manchin referred to West Virginia, an extraction state. So, there are other things to be done. You know, we can maybe do some more of the things that the other 95% of West Virginia does. You can teach. My goodness, you don't have to have a flat, dusty plateau in order to teach somebody. We have universities. We have good universities. we have universities that could be better, and we can have more universities. We could be a mecca of education. We're only 5 or 6 hours from, well, parts of West Virginia are just a hop and a skip from Washington, D.C., but there's non-timber forest products that could be processed in West Virginia. Why is it we have a very narrow ginseng season? If you dig ginseng outside that season, you are liable to be jailed because of your lawbreaking.
Unless, of course, you're blowing up an entire mountain's worth of ginseng, in which case, you know, you're a job creator.
Yeah,
and then, there's the future itself. An Appalachia that was adequately broadband wired could support, God knows, telecommuting in decentralized information industry all day long. But again, Appalachia goes begging for the infrastructure for that.
Yeah, and end up with shady providers that provide crappy service because, hey, who cares if so-and-so up the holler has adequate bandwidth and internet speed to do this thing that enables the telecommuting. And, you know, that is stuff people can do. People don't, you know, part of the problem with Appalachia is sometimes it's dang hard to get to work. If you got to go an hour to work and the cliff falls down on your road.
And that happens.
And that happened. It happened, 3 minutes away from our office. And that's how we found out the Collins Fort. Permit. I think that's how we found out that one had started, because there was a blasting point the same day a house side cliff fell onto the only road through the Coal River Valley, cutting it off for 2 months. But, you know, so you have that, you have flooding, you have trees down, things like that that make it hard to get very far to work. So, but there are things that people can do, and it's not, you know, it's not all quilting, whittling, and fiddling that seem to be the things that always come to the top when people talk about, well, what can Appalachians do? Oh, we can make quilts. Oh, we can carve. We can fiddle. It's that's nice.
Hey, we can start low budget shoestring internet radio networks.
Yeah, we can do that. We can do all kinds of. We can raise hemp, you know, if marijuana is ever legalized. It's already West Virginia's number one cash crop.
Imagine what would happen if it was taxed.
And imagine what would happen if the power companies didn't gouge the customers who really don't have much of a choice. $114 million coming out of communities every year to go into the coffers of whatever Appalachian Power does with their price gouging. That's kind of a tangent there, but, you know, it's a captive audience and not really a whole lot that people can do. So I encourage people to go to crmw.net, see the post about signing a petition opposing the price hike, because, you know, that's more money flowing out, and we need money to stay in Appalachia. We need money to flow into Appalachia instead of flowing out, as is the traditional thing. Walmarts are not economic development. That is taking local people's money and sending it to Arkansas and China. You know, but hemp, you know, that's money coming in. Our hemp volunteer, gosh, he's done so much. You know, Coal River Mountain Watch is a stock holding member of the West Virginia Farmers Cooperative. But he estimates with our little half acre of hemp that we can raise $10,000 worth of cannabidiol That's with the broadcast method of planting. He estimates we can double that next year if we plant differently, spacing the plants out farther. And, you know, just this year, a law was passed allowing us to save seeds, hemp seeds, because prior to this, we had to buy our seeds from Turkey or Bulgaria or somewhere, and with only about a 2% germination rate. But, you know, that is something that, and not just raise the hemp and turn it into hemp oil and hemp products for us to buy at 1,000% markup. Let's get some processing facilities in the area. Why not use some of these buildings? We don't need more flat land. We don't even need more buildings. We need to fix up some of the buildings we have and put viable, low, small scale industry into those that produce some of these high value products. But, you know, getting any sort of support for any of that from the state is crazy, because we're told that coal is all West Virginia has. Well, if coal is all West Virginia has, and coal provides employment for 5% of the population, what's the other 95% going to do? What's the other 95% doing?
Well, they're all the way they count coal jobs running, they're all making bologna sandwiches for the day shift.
And here's another thing, Bob, and this really grinds my gears. When we see well-meaning liberals saying that, you know, everybody in West Virginia gets what they deserve because, by golly, they voted for
Trump. Oh, that gets goes through me like a dose of salt.
Okay, so West Virginia has 5 electoral votes. And how many are in the Electoral College? Over 500. So less than 1% of the electoral vote gets 99% of the blame. And people say, well, I don't care that Trump did this thing to scrap the stream protection rule, or I don't care that he did this, or I don't care that this happened and that you're getting sick and dying from it. It's what you deserve. Well, what about the rest of the states that showed up red on that night in November? Are they getting what they deserve? Is Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Michigan, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Pennsylvania,
Wisconsin, Michigan,
Alabama. Yeah. Are they getting what they deserve too? I mean, is everybody getting what they deserve? Because I don't think we're.
Well, you know, when we start talking about deserving, I think of Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven saying, deserving's got nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I think that's true, because, you know, the rest of the country is now getting to experience what it's like to be in West Virginia, where you've got some crazy industries driving your politics for over a century. Welcome to West Virginia, America. Now you get to enjoy it too. So, you know, so there are. I got off on some weird tangent with that. But, you know, the things that West Virginians, this is where I was going. You know, people keep saying that West Virginia is, Trump country. Well, what about all those other red states? What about the 20,000 West Virginia teachers that occupied the Capitol demanding a better deal and better pay? What about those 20,000 teachers? Those 20,000 teachers are 4,000 or 5,000 more employees than the entire coal employment of West Virginia. Okay, there are more teachers in West Virginia than there are coal miners. There are more registered nurses in West Virginia than there are coal miners. There are more of lots of things than there are coal miners. Yet for some reason, that one industry gets to call the shots for everybody else. And it's time the rest of the people kind of looked past the wool that's over their eyes and see that, hey, maybe there are more of us than there are of them, and we can start doing something about it.
And there's something that goes hand in hand with that, and that is the ability to talk amongst ourselves. There's a lot of things can be said for Appalachian folks, hillbillies. I mean, I call myself a hillbilly, and it's not a mark of shame. But we can be a cantankerous lot. And, or let's see, another word for that is...
Oh, there's fighting words, Bob. I'll fight you for that.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, I know. or let's see, we can be cussed. We got some cussedness in us. And we don't take well to being told, not asked by God, but told what's good for us. And we don't much like it on either side, Republican or Democrat. And so when we get referred to as those people, which I just mistakenly did a little bit ago, it rubs us the wrong way. And so consequently, we've got to find a way to talk amongst ourselves in a neighborly fashion. Now, it is admittedly hard to talk to those angry coal miners. But, you know, maybe somewhere along the way it's possible. It's amazing how the scales fall away from people's eyes when they're no longer being paid to go and show up at rallies and protests and hearings. Because all of a sudden it doesn't have the same resonance anymore.
Yeah, and you know that's we try to exemplify things that are alternatives, and where we're at the Judy Bond Center, right across the street from the post office in Naoma, right on Route 3, the only road through the valley, and there are neighbors that didn't take kindly to having their kids be given a shirt that said Marsh Fork Elementary, whatever it said, Brighter Days or Pathway to a Brighter Future or something like that, after we got out of school. But the idea, the myths that are out there, you know, one of them is that solar does not work. That's not going to work. Well, we're poised to demonstrate that, yes, it does work. And the next time a derecho comes along and wipes out 70% of West Virginia's electric power, and we've got our battery backup and need a charge phone, come on over. Need a hot meal, need a place to stay. Yeah, come on over.
Yeah, it's 104 degrees outside. You got an elderly person in your home that's about to have a heat stroke. Come on in.
Yeah, come on over. We got a fan. And that's demonstrating that, you know, the things that people have been told for so long is just not true. It wasn't that long ago that we heard some guy saying that miners would be working their asses off and that coal is coming back in a big way, and it's just not happening. I think actually,
no. In point of fact, it's going.
Power plants are being retired now than there were during Obama's administration.
Exactly. So, during the first 3 months of Trump regime. I'm sorry. During the first 45 days of 2018, more coal capacity was retired than in the entire first 3 years of the Obama administration.
Yeah, so, it's like, we're here, we're trying to be nice to everybody.
Yeah, how do you blame that on the Obama EPA war on coal?
Well, now, Obama didn't do anything about 9/11, and he was probably playing golf during Katrina. Didn't do anything about that either, so, those are his fault as well.
What isn't?
Yeah. So... I think the war on coal, that myth is going to be felt for a long time. But there are people who most of our board and staff have people in their family or have been coal employees themselves who you know the truth. And, you know, it's just a matter of being free of the propaganda, being free of, you know, being free of the misinformation that, you know, bless their hearts, the West Virginia media still always says, you know, anything the coal industry says, they treat that as gospel truth. And then anything that we say is environmentalists say, you know. So, but, I mean, we're going to win one way or the other. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, is there going to be anything left? But, I don't know. And it's frustrating that we have the Paul Krugman articles that make it sound like, hey, brighter days are just around the corner, and those nasty coal barons have, you know, gone away and left you alone, whereas in fact they're just still scraping out every little bit that they can and don't care who they kill in the process. But, you know, so there's a couple of things. We've got to address that directly. We've got to tackle that. We've got to pass the AIC Act. We've got to stop mountaintop removal. We've got to kick the robber barons out of town. And we also need to provide something else for people to do. That's not really our job, but since the people that are supposed to be doing it aren't doing it, we're doing it. So, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And it's the other part of that article is that, you know, the solar is booming. Wind and solar are booming. Well, they're not booming. They're not booming here like they need to be. I mean, there are heroic efforts being made, but people have to have access to it in order to leverage it. And it's a little more it's a little more complicated than it's being portrayed as well, is it not?
Yeah, it is. And you know, the solar industry in West Virginia is growing. You know, the people who installed the solar panels on our roof are, you know, they're growing. They're posting almost every few days another picture of a site of a home or business that they've solarized. And some of the other things are, you know, not getting the attention that they need. You know, the low-hanging fruit is always, when it comes to energy, the low-hanging fruit is efficiency and conservation. And West Virginia's homes and businesses could save a lot. You know, we're talking people saving actual money, especially as the power companies keep jacking the price up. They're saving a lot by weatherizing their homes, getting those energy audits done and things. And I don't know if they're still doing it or not, but CASE, I forget what that's the acronym for, but they were based in Princeton, and they were doing energy audits and home weatherizations, and they had like 2 years worth of backlog, and this was a few years ago. I don't know if they're still being funded or not, or if they're still doing that work, but that's something people can do. There was a study in 2011. Not 2011. It's been since then, 2016, I think. That if just using common sense efficiency measures, many of which are already in place in neighboring states, West Virginia could hire 19,000 people doing energy efficiency work. Now, that is more than the entire coal employment in West Virginia. But you don't hear about that because it's not coal.
And it doesn't fit the narrative.
It doesn't fit the narrative that there's nothing else that can be done. And it doesn't fit the narrative of the guy saying, well, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be retrained. I don't want to do anything other than what I'm already doing. So I'm going to fight for my job blowing up the mountain And because I don't want to change. You know, it's so unfair that I might have to get another job or take a job at lower pay. And, you know, some of the same folks that are always saying, get a job, you dirty hippie. Well, how about you get a job? I don't want that job. I want to be making what I'm making now. I'm not going to take anything less. So there's some hypocrisy there.
Oh, a little bit, but, yeah.
There have been many times when people have said, well, yeah, I'd stop my cold job if I could have another job paying the same as I'm making now. And it's, you know, for West Virginia, it's good. For the rest of the country, it's not that outlandish, you know. But I think you start at something like $18 or $20 an hour working for the coal industry, and you might, you know, if you have some specialized skill as a roof bolter or electrician or something like that, you might end up making $100,000 a year or something along those lines, which is damn good money. But, you know, most of the folks doing it aren't doing those jobs making $100,000 a year. But there's still that myth, that persistent myth that we've got all these coal miners that are going to be out of work if we end up on top of the middle. And that's just not the case.
And oddly enough, there are a lot of transferable skills there.
Sure. I mean, if you can drive a bulldozer for a mountaintop removal site, you can drive a bulldozer making a pad for a wind turbine. You can drive a bulldozer building a road or in construction. If you're an electrician,
and you know, right? That's where I was going to say.
Electrician anywhere.
Well, if you can run electricity to a mine, you can damn sure learn how to run electricity off of a wind turbine farm or off of a solar farm.
Yeah.
And those things have to be maintained, too. That's maintenance work. So
it is. And those are long-term jobs. Those are permanent jobs. The wind doesn't go away and the sun doesn't go away. I mean, it's been pretty reliable for billions of years.
And so, you know, here we are, a couple of hillbillies, Vernon, talking about these things. But what we lack is this is me. This has nothing to do with Coal River Mountain Watch. What we lack are candidates in this state with the political will and the skill set and the intelligence to bring these ideas to fruition. And then we need them in Washington, D.C. too. And, you know, part of the eight campaign's work, a big part of it is educational. In some instances, we go into congressional offices, House and Senate both, and, you know, we're not there talking about the AIC Act per se. Hell, it's not even introduced in the Senate. We are just educating staffers about things they have never even heard of, about a place they never even imagined they could be even remotely interested in caring about. And when you put the spark to that tinder, you're hoping that eventually you'll get a little energy out of it, so that you know, Appalachia can be a part of prosperity. I mean, I remember the boom, the economic boom of the 1990s. Well, I was living here, Vernon. We didn't see it. It wasn't here. There's not much different now between now and the 1990s, and there wasn't much different during the economic collapse of 2008 and the 1990s. We don't participate in when the rest of the country prospers. We don't. And somewhere along the way, and I think the necessary work that Coal River Mountain Watch does has to be. A part of that forward vision. And I sit in amazement every day, like I said, that so much gets accomplished by a tiny handful of hardworking, incredibly brave people. Because the one thing you haven't mentioned along the way is there aren't too many people who have been with Coal River Mountain Watch for any length of time at all who at one time or another have not had their lives threatened. It's not just that you get a dirty look down at the Rippy Mart.
I mean, it was...
it's that they will try...
2 years ago that somebody cut Junior's brake lines. You know, and it's... I've been threatened, he's been threatened. And it's... You know, there's... You hear about post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, you know, that implies that the source of the stress is over.
Yeah, right, post.
Yeah, it's post. So, you know, I would imagine that a lot of people who are activists in Appalachia have some sort of traumatic stress ongoing. Don't want to diagnose anybody with a disorder yet, but my goodness, the ongoing stress is not just the stress of, is the air that I'm breathing going to kill me soon? Is it going to kill my kids? Is it going to kill my unborn children? Or is somebody from the coal company going to kill me today? Is somebody going to run me off the road? Somebody going to cut the brake line? Somebody just shoot me. Because in Coal River Valley, it takes a good while. When somebody got shot at the Hillbilly Bar and murdered there in the parking lot, it took an hour for the cops to get there. You know, when the convenience store in Whitesville, between Pettus and Whitesville, got robbed, and the clerk called the state police, and the state police said, "Well, is the robber still there?" And they said, "No, he's gone." They said, "Well, call us back if he comes back."
Jesus!
it's ridiculous, but so you have that ongoing threat of violence, you know, and when we take people up on Casered Knot, we still point out some of the bullet holes and some of the structures up there where angry miners have shot at the homes. It's not pretty. I mean, the coal industry has not ever been known for their peaceful, loving ways. But and then on top of all that, you have the stress of, gosh, are we going to be able to make payroll? Are we going to be able to continue doing the work? Are we going to be able to pay the bills? You know, when, you know, we ask for grants and get responses of, you know, well-meaning folks, but sometimes we don't. A lot of times we don't get what we ask for, or we get something reduced from what we ask for, and sometimes those grants that we get don't allow any or very much for salaries because, you know, it's labor intensive. It's labor intensive for somebody to go up on a mountain and watch a drone and try to observe these sites, or go into a creek and test the water, or go into a holler and pick up trash, or take kids to a field trip, or tend the hemp field, or many of these other things that just take labor. It's labor. It's work. And for some reason, so many foundations and just do not recognize that as a thing that they should pay for. However, you know, if we want to contract somebody else, if we want to subcontract our work to somebody else, we can do that sometimes. But we don't want to do that. Why would we? Who would do it? I mean, it's not like you got activists sitting around that are experienced and as feed on the issues and the techniques and the strategies that you can just, you know, go down to the local temporary activist agency and hire somebody. But, you know, that's kind of getting off on that tangent there. But, you know, people say, well, why don't you just volunteer and do something else and volunteer? It's like, what else are we going to do? You know, 95% of West Virginia workforce does something other than coal, but the locations of those jobs are not in the Coal River Valley.
Probably at least partially by design, but that highlights the fact that you know, this is full-time work. And you know,
it's full-time work. It's not something that you can just pitch in a few hours a week of volunteer work and do effectively. Just pouring through, a lot of what I do is going through the permit files online with DEP posts and think, what kind of sneaky thing are they up to now? That takes time. So many things take a lot of time, and it is full time. It's not something you can drive for an hour to work in Beckley, do your job there, and come back and have any sort of family time. I mean, I've done that before. I used to do that. And spend, get home at 5 or 6 and or 7, depending on the day, and then be working as a volunteer until the wee hours of the morning. But that's not sustainable.
No, and you mentioned PTSD a little bit ago, and Riley mentioned that the stress has to be post. When it's ongoing, it's a different matter. I don't know, you're like me, I don't know how many seminars I've sat through where the issue of self-care has come up. Because the difference, and, this has been a very broad, wide-ranging conversation, and I think it's really good for people to hear the reality of activism, because the right wing's out there, and they constantly make jokes about social justice warriors or environmental justice warriors. Well, by God, the struggle is real. And the fact of the matter is, if you work for the company that's blowing the bejesus out of Coal River Mountain, at the end of your shift, you go home. And it's over.
Yeah, and you got 45 minutes or an hour to Shady Spring or
right. But you got paid for what you do, and they don't expect you necessarily, unless there's a rally to attend or something like that. The rest of your day is yours.
Yeah, you can go to your kid's ball game. You can go to your kid's ball game. You can go to a movie. You can do those things.
But in the grassroots, because it's a life or death situation, it's something that you live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I can't tell you, and this is just a little tiny example, I can't tell you how sick my kids got of hearing me walking through the house and turning off the light in the bathroom and saying, hey, I'm turning off the light in the very well-lighted empty bathroom. They blow up mountains for that. And, Jesus, Dad. But it's true, and you live it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's never a minute away from your consciousness. And that's just me and the little bit that I'm involved with. To live down there, to be in it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and to have somebody say, "Well, why don't you volunteer?" There's no there's no telling what Coal River Mountain Watch could do if it was adequately funded. And Coal River Mountain Watch is not, let's be clear about things, Coal River Mountain Watch is not adequately funded. So, God, Vernon, how long have you been at this?
Started as a volunteer in 2004, got hired in 2005, so 13 years.
Yeah. I started working on the issue in 2004 as well. We're about a week apart in terms of age and birthdays too. So there's a lot of similarity there. But it takes a toll. I don't know. I wish I could, you mentioned Junior. I have so much respect for Junior because he knows the area like the back of his hand, and in the face of everything, he will not give up. Bless his heart, that is the hard-headedest young man I think I've ever known. Because he could have been making big bucks in the coal industry. He's from around there. He's the kind of people they want to hire.
He worked for him for a while.
Yeah.
And he actually did. So,
and yet he's paid a price. He's sick. He struggles with his health, and it's not because of his hard living either. He's one of the gentlest people I know. And I want people to know the work that goes into this, because like I said, the whole thing that lit this fire was the quote from Paul Krugman. And the idea that he's in New York and he lives this intensely privileged life where even when he's complaining about things that he doesn't like, he's well off enough that they never really touch him. And mountaintop removal certainly doesn't touch him. And I'm pretty willing to bet that wherever he lives, whether it be in New Jersey or Manhattan or wherever, I'm pretty sure that that's not all sustainable energy that makes the lights come on when he flips the switch. And it's probably not even all frack gas. And then there's fracking. But there are realities that the American people have no idea obtain. And if it weren't for conversations like this, people wouldn't know. I mean, I wish that this particular, you know, we run live here, but we also put out a podcast. I wish tens of thousands of people could hear this conversation. I wish a million people could hear this conversation and know the nature of the work and know the difficulties that are involved in all of this and the sacrifices that are made. Because, frankly, regardless of whether it's the side we oppose or the side that is supposedly our allies, I don't think either one really, really knows what goes into this. And I don't think our side fully understands what's at stake. You know, this is the cradle of climate change, Appalachia. And, you know, we'll see where, hopefully a few more people will know that didn't know before. But Vernon, I really appreciate the time you spent with us this evening. You've given me 2.5 hours of your time. And I hope that it proves beneficial in just in getting people to a more intense on the ground level of understanding of the nature of this struggle that even our own allies say isn't even taking place anymore. Thank you, Vernon.
Just before I get off really quick, one of the things that we do host visitors. We host we provide tours. Come for a tour with Junior and see the stuff for yourself. I mean, it doesn't take that long to go up to the edge of an active mountaintop removal site and see for real that it's not over. So,
Paul Krugman, come on down. I bet Southwings would even fly Paul. I bet Southwings would even fly Paul Krugman over some active mountaintop removal.
They would, and we would provide him with some gloves to pull weeds and hemp patch and trash bag to pick up some trash in the river. And all that kind of fun stuff, but come see it in person. Well, thanks, Bob. I appreciate the time.
Oh, my pleasure, and thanks for helping out.
Hopefully somebody's listening.
Well, there people are listening. Now it's up to them to spread the information. You know, it's like the Bible says, be ye hearers of the word and not be ye doers of the word and not hearers only.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All right. Take care, Vernon.
Everybody go to you. Thanks, Bob.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's Vernon Haltom, co-executive director of Coal River Mountain Watch. You can find their work on Facebook at Coal River Mountain Watch, also at crmw.net. And if you'd like to be part of the struggle, if you would like to help the work that Coal River Mountain Watch does, then, you know, sign up for a regular monthly subscription. Again, well, it's probably not even the half of a McDonald's hamburger at a $10 a month subscription that we talk about here, because the work goes on pretty much 24/7, not just 3 hours of radio. So it's probably less than a penny an hour, with the caveat that I'm not so good at ciphering. But follow the work. Learn the work. And when you see something like a Paul Krugman, who's up to his eyeballs in privilege, saying that mountaintop removal is something that used to happen, that it was something we were doing, that was going on, please know that what that person is doing is betraying their own ignorance. Because the poisoning is going on now. The dying is going on now. The diseases are going on now. Because the blasting is going on now. So, again, thank you very kindly to Vernon Haltom. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. It's 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time right now, and it just feels a little false to jump off into a generic rant about this, that, and the other thing that have taken place today, the outrage du jour, and God knows there's an outrage out there. I think we'll probably save it for tomorrow. And what I'm going to ask, you know, we opened the program with a $400 fundraising deficit. I'm just gonna waive that. I am. Just forget it. And we'll try to find some way to make it through May. But what I would like to find out, I'll check in with Vernon tomorrow. I'd like to see if there are, between now and sometime tomorrow, I'd like to see if maybe there can be $400 in contributions to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go there. Maybe sign up for that $10 a month. And we'll figure out, you know, we'll figure out a way to make it here. But we had it. We had a 2-day deficit anyway. Let's take that $400, and I'm not going to get on the air tomorrow and say that there's a $600 deficit. I'm not going to do that. But in the name of the poisoned of Appalachia, in the name of the sacrificed in the sacrifice zone. And I know, and as I've said before, there are a lot more people that listen to this program than contribute to keep it on the air. That's fine. But even if you listen to this program and you don't contribute to keep it on the air, forget that. Tonight, I'm asking you, kindly, politely, I'm imploring, to go and sign up for a $10 a month contribution to Coal River Mountain Watch. Now, out of the significant number of people who listen to this program, if just 40 people do that, that'll make up that $400. And I will consider it, well, not a favor, but an act of manifest humanity, decency, and mercy toward people that even those on our side tend to diminish if they can even bother to remember them. So can that happen? I don't know. If it does, it'll be magnificent. Because that would be, well, it won't get us anywhere near the executive director salary of a big green or anything, but it will be it'll be a drop of rain on dirt that is baked mighty dry and is absolutely parched. Okay? Can we do that? So I'll thank you all very much. And we'll get back to hell raising and kicking ass tomorrow. And I hope you understand why I feel like just, no, it doesn't work to sort of generically bail into the chaos of the day and the outrage du jour. Although I would be severely remiss if I did not simply say that today, of all the outrageous things he has said and done, today I think we learned, if we had not learned before, we learned everything we ever needed to know about Donald Trump. My God. It's mind-boggling. It is. Well, here's what I thought of. I remembered back when I remembered back when the Nazis marched on Charlottesville, and a couple of dozen people were injured and Heather Heyer was killed by Nazis. In that moment, Donald Trump, with an opportunity to condemn vicious right-wing hate, went out of his way to say that, yeah, well, there were some Nazis there, but there were also some very fine people. Today, there was a roundtable about California sanctuary cities. And like I said, in that moment, we learned everything we could ever have needed to know about Donald Trump as if we didn't already know it. This much I will do. I'm going to play that clip because this clip needs to be played forever. There are no very fine immigrants. No. No, there aren't.
We have people coming into the country, or trying to come in. We're stopping a lot of them. But we're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before. And because of the weak laws, they come in fast. We get them, we release them, we get them again, we bring them out. It's crazy. The dumbest laws, as I said before, the dumbest laws on immigration in the world. So
I'm so old. I remember when people had their hair catch on fire when a clip was played from, what, 1995 of Hillary Clinton saying that super predators had to be brought to heel. To one degree or another, it may have cost her the election, along with a whole bunch of other stuff, but it may have. People may have gone over and voted for Jill Stein because of super predators brought to heel. But today, Donald Trump defined people, an entire group of people, as animals. I'm seeing people on social media who say that they are absolutely shaking with rage and hurt at this. And while there are apparently some very fine Nazis, well, he's adopted the language, apparently, of those very, very fine Nazis. And for the love of God, where does it end? Animals. Animals. It's not violating Godwin's law to say that that is the exact same sort of language that was used in the Third Reich. It is merely accurate and factual. Animals. So we'll close the program a few minutes ahead of schedule. We'll get back to the chaos du jour tomorrow. But understand, the crux of the conversation with Vernon tonight was the fact that they won't even obey the laws that are written to benefit them, the coal industry. They're mining on a permit right now that doesn't exist. Completely rogue, completely outlaw. And the only way to stop it is with the determined action of the grassroots. So, we're just going to forget about the deficit this evening. Thank you, Larry, for jumping in. Thank you. That was very kind of you. And instead, let's get 40 people to go over and sign up for $10 a month over at Coal River Mountain Watch. Okay? Thanks to all of you for sharing your precious finite time engaging in this little ongoing conversation. Thank you to all of you who support this program and keep it on the air. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you for popping in as a pinch hit chat room moderator this evening, Brother Deacon Asa. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Asa, for headon.live. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And this time I said it at the front end and I'll say it at the back. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Not .org, not .com, not .dot anything else. CRMW.net. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.